very pleased to welcome to the stage Bob Iger of The Walt Disney Company. He is Chairman and Chief Executive. As Chairman and CEO, Mr. Iger is a steward of the world's largest media company and some of the most respected and beloved brands in the world. Mr. Iger has built on Disney's rich history of unforgettable storytelling with the acquisitions of Pixar, Marvel, and Lucasfilm, and more recently with the landmark opening of Disney's first theme park and resort in mainland China in Shanghai. So thank you very much for joining us, Bob.
Thanks, Drew.
We're coming up on your 11-year anniversary as CEO. Under your leadership, the company has thrived on many measures. As you reflect back on your time, which of your skills or attributes have been most important in contributing to your success in running the company?
Well, I don't know whether I would focus on my skills and my attributes. I can just tell you what I did and what we did when I got the job. First thing, and I think it's pretty important, was pretty important, was to create and articulate a very clear strategy, one that was focused and one that we could communicate throughout the company and outside the company as well with great clarity, and one that we could actually implement, one that was deliverable. And interestingly enough, doing that very much led to, even though it happened fast, the acquisition of Pixar and then the subsequent acquisitions that you talked about. And as I look back on the 11 years, first of all, the strategy is still in place, which is to put most of our capital in the direction of high-quality branded content, to use technology to distribute more broadly, to get closer to the customer, to make the product better, and then to grow globally in a more profound way than we had been. And so just mentioning the things that you mentioned, I'm sure there's certainly a technology element to all of this. I think it is clear that the strategy worked and the strategy is still working. The other thing I would add, which maybe is a little bit more personal, and that is a willingness to take risks, the courage to ask questions about the status quo, challenge the status quo, the courage to be curious about things and to actually do new things, the courage to take big bets, even though there's risk associated with all of them. And I guess I was born with a little bit of that or enough of it to be able to do this job the way I've been doing it for 11 years.
So within the portfolio, you obviously have a lot of businesses that touch the consumer. And so I'm wondering if you could share some perspectives on what you see as the health of the consumer, maybe particularly in the U.S. We've seen some data points suggesting that the health of the U.S. consumer is not so strong. Maybe you could talk about that sort of broadly and maybe also provide a little bit of an update of how you're finishing out your fiscal year.
Generally speaking, we actually see a relatively healthy consumer in the United States. We see that through a few different lenses. Clearly, theme parks is probably the biggest one. And frankly, our domestic business from both Orlando and California is quite strong. And we've seen no sign whatsoever of a consumer slowdown or issues with the consumer. And I'd say looking forward, the same would be the case, not just looking back. We'll be more specific when we announce earnings in November, but our advanced bookings are relatively strong. The other side we see is consumer products. For us, that's retail mostly. That can be cyclical based on product we have in the marketplace, but that's been strong as well. In terms of how we're finishing the year, we've had just a hair under 20% growth over the last 4 years as a company. And through the first three quarters of this year, our fiscal year ends in a week, we've been up 17%. So that's been quite a run. This quarter, actually, we're generally quite pleased with. There is a comparability factor. We had a 53rd week last year, fiscal 2015. That's reflected from a comparability perspective in the fourth quarter that we will announce. And that amounts to about $350 million of operating income as a negative comp. And more than half of it, a majority of it, is cable networks. But generally speaking, we're pleased with the performance that we're seeing. Obviously, we'll be more specific in 6 weeks' time.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, under your leadership, you've made several notable acquisitions. And recently, you made another notable one, the $1 billion investment for a one-third stake in BAMTech with an option to increase to a majority position at a later date. BAMTech's very different than some of the other acquisitions, which were more content-driven, Pixar, Marvel, Lucasfilm. Now, what led you to the BAMTech investment and this need to own rather than rent this technology capability?
Well, I'll come back to the own versus rent, but what led us to it is through what I touched upon when I talked about strategic priorities. We're a big believer in using technology to reach more people and to reach people where they are today. And clearly, we've seen dramatic increases in digital mobile media. We actually were fairly prescient about that, citing what could be a real trend or growth in that area back in 2005 when we agreed to put ABC TV shows on that quaint little device called a video iPod. So we believed for a long time that mobile digital media was going to become a fairly big deal, and in fact it has. It's still relatively small compared with some of the traditional platforms in terms of consumption, but it's growing and it's grown significantly. So what BAMTech represented to us, particularly for ESPN, was an enabler of sorts and a very high quality one. We were extremely impressed with how robust, how great their platform was and the business they had already created. It was a great way for us to move ESPN and probably other Disney assets onto digital mobile platforms in a more effective way. One of the reasons why we wanted to invest is we thought it was a good investment. We believed in the growth of that platform, and by investing and having a good seat at the table gives us the ability to learn a lot more about what works, what doesn't work, what the consumer, how the consumer is essentially using the platform, pricing issues, you name it. We thought that was really valuable. And then, of course, for ESPN, if you want to look at it just from that business perspective, you know, sports is clearly something that a lot of people are really passionate about, particularly young men. They use mobile devices fairly frequently. ESPN's goal has always been to super serve their fan. One way to do that is to be present in more places on more platforms. And so they viewed this as a great complement to the services that they already provide. And then lastly, ESPN, when it licenses content, when it licenses sports from the various leagues and schools, et cetera, and so on, in almost all cases, buys both traditional media rights and digital media rights. So ESPN has a treasure trove of digital rights for 99% of the sports that it covers that it is not fully exploiting on new platforms, and it fully intends ultimately to do that. So there's a monetization factor here, and again, owning, I guess you could argue, wasn't absolutely necessary in that case, but this will give us the ability with BAMTech to create complementary product to ESPN and to mine the gold mine of those rights that ESPN has, I think, more effectively.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, in more detail, the strategy with the new ESPN service? I mean, we call it ESPN Lite. I think a lot of people have called it ESPN Lite. Because you've mentioned on the
new service, meaning the one that we've loosely discussed that we'll launch on BAM?
Yes, that one. You know, because on the last call you mentioned dynamic pricing options. I mean, could you elaborate a little bit on what the plan is?
Well, right now the plan is at some point, probably in 17, with BAM we'll launch a branded ESPN service that will include a lot of the rights that I just talked about, which rights that we bought that we're not exploiting on the primary services. Let's look at it as an add-on product, not a product that is a substitute product for ESPN, the mothership. And so we've got this huge collection of rights that we can use to create an additional sports service. I think a lot of people think about it as sort of a monthly fee or a yearly subscription. We haven't really gotten that far in terms of our planning, but one of the things that we have been talking about is that it should not be a kind of a one-size-fits-all. You can offer the whole thing to people who may want to pay for, I'll call it that bundle of sports rights on a monthly basis, but we think where the market could be going in terms of some of these sports is being able to buy it very, very selectively a specific sport, maybe even for a specific season or a specific date, or a specific weekend. This is what Sky does in the UK, for instance, with a lot of its Premier League rights. And we think that that could be really interesting for fans that may not want to buy another bundle of sports rights, but maybe want very specific sports that they're willing to step up and pay for, again, provided it gives them mobility and the ability to watch wherever they are.
So find that passionate fan that's really into maybe it's a more of a niche sport or a niche team and give them the option at a reasonable price to subscribe to that.
Yes, and again, we're looking at this as a complementary service to what we already have. I know a lot has been said about the future of the traditional media business, and I think we're pretty mindful of the fact that we've seen a fair amount of change over the last decade, and we actually we've been, as you know, very candid about that as well. We're not doing this, though, because we think that the current business model is in any way crumbling. We're doing it because we think we have more opportunity to reach more sports fans. And we're also doing it because we can't predict right now where the business goes over time or when it goes someplace over time, but we certainly feel we need to be fully prepared for dramatic shifts should they occur, and this is one step in that direction.
Okay. On sports rights, you're fortunate that ESPN, a lot of the deals are, don't expire for several more years, but, we've also seen some new entrance into the sports television business, from the internet and technology space. I wonder, what's your strategy in terms of trying to fend off these new entrants over the next couple of years?
Well, as I said a few minutes ago, save for a small percentage of the rights that ESPN buys, we have those digital rights. So when ESPN is covering almost all of its sports, there can't be a new entrant for the sports that ESPN has already licensed. And you mentioned long-term and their deals for not only the primary leagues, meaning baseball, the NBA, which kicks in 17, a new deal, and the NFL, and then many of the major sports conferences, those deals could last a long time. So there can't really be a new entrant offering a side-by-side product for almost all of what ESPN has. That said, I think when you think about these new entrants, and I thought Twitter actually did a very good job last week. Interestingly enough, that platform was powered by BAMTech last week and will be, which I think says a lot about that platform because it was very stable. I checked it out, as did a lot of people, and I thought it was quite a good experience. They did a good job. But you have to think about monetization capabilities of these new entrants. You can think about monetization capabilities of even the current entrants. Nobody can monetize sports better than ESPN for a variety of reasons. First of all, the great combination of advertising and subscription fees, which is obviously very large. ESPN's ability to monetize across multiple platforms and serve advertisers in multiple ways as well. That's stunning, actually, when you think about what they've done. They're far ahead of anybody else digitally in terms of sports, I'll call it television. And so while these new entrants are clearly interested in gaining rights to support their own growth or their own strategic growth priorities, if you think about them in terms of direct competitors to the current incumbent sports rights owners, and that's not just ESPN, but NBC and CBS and Fox, and Turner, to name a few, the new entrants, at least in the foreseeable future, would have a really hard time monetizing anything close to the level of the traditional players. And that doesn't mean they don't have the money to do so in some cases. They have the capital, but they would dig deep into their pockets and be doing something that would be a loss leader and then some if they were to do it. I don't mean to in any way suggest complacency. There's always been competition for sports rights. You could argue that that's not going away because of the value of live and the purity of that audience from a demographic perspective. But I think that it'll be a while before any of them can monetize close enough to what we've monetized, and therefore it's going to be hard for them to compete on an equal playing field, no pun intended.
Okay.
Level playing field.
Let's move away from sports and towards sort of the TV business. And, you know, it seems like the industry collectively made a lot of progress over the past year with in-season stacking rights, in-season VOD stacking rights. Disney announced two deals recently with AT&T and Comcast, two of the largest MVPDs. You know, but the progress has been slow up until this point, you know, because the deals are very complicated. There's all kinds of pre-existing deals between distributors and production studios and networks. But I was wondering, generally, can you talk about your strategy for VOD and SVOD and how it's been evolving over the past couple of years?
I don't think I can give you many headlines except to say that we've had two goals on the television side. One is make great product. Two, monetize it as best that we possibly can. And when we think about ways to monetize it, we're thinking about that over the long term, not just the short term. It's been our belief of late, meaning over the last year, that obviously one great way to monetize is on the multi-platform, in a multi-platform way, not multi-platform, sorry, a multi-channel way, the MVP through MVPDs. Clearly, we're getting paid well for that. And therefore, the stacking deals that we've done, which is to put in-season program, in-season stacking on the MVPDs, is done because we'd like the MVPDs to continue to be able to provide us with monetization, a robust form of monetization over a long period of time. It's really that simple. And you're right, a lot of progress has been made. That said, we also balance that with all the other buyers that are now out there for these rights. We think we're striking a good balance between out-of-season rights, meaning prior season rights, and current season rights by putting current season on the giving current season to the MVPDs and the MVPD subscribers, and selling prior season rights to a variety of entrants into the marketplace, of which we know there are, you know, many of them. And that seems right now to be a smart play for us. I can't speak for everyone else, but it seems to be a smart play for us. And I think it's actually very pro-consumer, too, because consumers, if they're really interested in gaining access to a show, particularly binge viewing under current circumstances, meaning current season, you don't want to send them to multiple places. It's not a great experience. By being in one place, the channel that they can watch the show live or the platform, and the channel or the platform that they can see all episodes of that show in this current season, that's, I think, a real positive from a consumer perspective.
Would you be trying over time to help reinforce the value of the traditional MVPD subscription? Would you try to sell them more, even more stacking rights, right? So right now it's in season. Past seasons are being sold to others. I mean, is there a demand from the MVPDs for those rights to, you know, the first couple seasons of?
No, not really. I think they probably like them, but they know that there's a lot of value there, and they're going to have to be competitive. If they stepped up and were competitive to the Netflix and the Hulus and the Amazons of this world, we'd have obviously, you know, all the interest in the world to sell it to them, but they'd have to be competitive. We would be leaving way too much money on the table for us and for our partners, I mean, our creative partners, if we were to simply say all seasons of a show have to be on the MVPD because we want to keep that ecosystem healthy. I think that would be probably the wrong way. That would not be pro-monetization.
Yeah. It's interesting because technology is, you know, helping enable some of this because on day one of our conference, Brian Roberts came and he gave us a demo of their new Xfinity platform with the Netflix integration in it. And he ran through a couple different searches and things. But, you know, one of the things he did is he searched for a political drama. And it pulled up, obviously, House of Cards from Netflix and Scandal from ABC and a couple of others. And, you know, it was interesting when he happened to click on Scandal. And, you know, there was the ABC logo, which is important, so you kind of get that branding still. But, you know, the in-season was through the X1 platform, and the first, I forget, four seasons of Scandal is coming from Netflix. So the technology is helping enable the consumer. It's sort of transparent to the consumer now, you know, who has what and where. You know, it's probably a good thing. It's very pro-consumer.
Yes, I think, listen, you have to think about it. I agree with you in terms of not just TV, but think about music as a for instance, and you go to iTunes and you look for a song, and you're not buying that song necessarily from the record company that
that
publishes the song or even the album necessarily. You're doing it really because you want the song, and it's findable cross really creators or distributors, or this distributor is in this case is Apple. Same thing is true, obviously, you mentioned it for Netflix, but even Google in search terms. You know, you get those results from anywhere for the most part, and you can enable a brand to travel with the product, which we try very hard to do. It's a conversation we've actually had with Netflix because it's important that our brand, including the ABC brand, but of course the Disney brand and the Marvel brand and the Star Wars Lucas brand, we want those to travel as well, because that's quite important and quite important to the consumer. But in terms of usability, findability, technology is breaking walls down clearly between the originator of the content and the distributor.
Let's switch over to theme parks. Let's talk a little bit about Shanghai, which has been open for more than 3 months now. You previously said over 1 million visitors came in the first month. You know, how should investors think about the market potential, and how quickly do you see Shanghai ramping up to full capacity?
We've had a fantastic opening for Shanghai, starting with opening day. We're not updating specific numbers, except I can say that had it not been for some typhoon-like weather there last week, the first 100 days of Shanghai would have delivered more in attendance than any park that we've ever opened. And in fact, it delivered more in the first 100 days than most parks that we've opened over the history of our theme parks. What we do know is from guest satisfaction surveys that we take, and we're sticklers at that, we do that a lot, is that people love this park. They love the experience. We have attractions and shows that are off the charts in terms of popularity. We also see that because they're staying a lot longer per visit than we ever expected, by a lot, by almost 2 hours. So they're coming to stay, and clearly they're enjoying what they're doing because they're staying even longer than we ever expected. So I think it bodes really well. We have ample expansion possibilities there. We're already building an expanded land, which we broke ground on before we opened this park, but we've not been specific about what it is or when it will open. And we have tons of land there to build even more, and we're in design on a lot of it and discussion on a lot of it with our partners. So I think that the fact that it is being well received by the Chinese consumer, and I don't know the exact numbers, but virtually everyone that goes there is from China. That is a great thing for not only the Disney theme park brand, but a great thing for Disney in that marketplace, which was one of the goals, the great, great brand beacon for the company. In terms of what else it represents growth-wise for the company, we haven't really been that specific about timing to profitability or absolute numbers. We haven't even gotten to the point where we've decided what we'll say when we announce earnings in the quarter. But so far, so good. Actually, I'd say it has exceeded our expectations in terms of the popularity of it and the likability of it. It was one of the things that we were very, very mindful of was opening something that was culturally sensitive and that would be viewed by the people of China as theirs, and that's clearly been the case. There's not been one false note in that regard, and we're extremely proud of that.
I wonder,
you went, by the way.
I did go. It's an amazing park. It's an amazing accomplishment, and I do agree with what you said. I think you struck a good balance between sort of, the local culture and flavor, but also having those distinctive Disney touches. It's an amazing park.
And by the way, the other thing we found that was interesting in the 100 days or so that we've been open is we knew that Shanghai was a tourist destination for the rest of China. But our anticipation when we opened was that the attendance would be dominated by people from Shanghai. And actually, it was dominated by people from China, but outside of Shanghai. And what that told us that was really interesting was that the marketing was really effective, and we didn't even market that much outside of Shanghai, meaning word of mouth has been great. And the fact that we captured the Shanghai tourist during a peak tourist season, obviously Chinese New Year is the other peak season, that's a really good thing, that local people in Shanghai can go anytime because it's proximate to them. And actually, our pricing dropped. We went to off-peak pricing this month, for instance. So it's even more affordable for the local resident. And we think that actually will end up serving us really well.
I wonder, you obviously have the Hong Kong Park. I'm wondering, have you noticed any impact on attendance to the Hong Kong Park since you opened the Shanghai Park?
No. Hong Kong had a tough year, in part because of some of the, I'll call it, political unrest in Hong Kong and drop-off, and that was significant, of visitation from mainland China to Hong Kong. We've seen some improvement in that in the recent, I don't know, 10 to 15 weeks or so, and we've been encouraged by that. But we have not, and because we've seen actually a rebound in Hong Kong since we opened Shanghai, we are concluding that Shanghai has not had a negative impact on Hong Kong at all.
Okay.
The other thing, by the way, that I should have touched on earlier when I talked about the consumer, and I meant to mention it, but now that we're talking theme parks, we also said fairly recently that we've seen no impact in the United States in Orlando because of Zika. That's still the case, by the way. No discernible impact whatsoever from that.
That's good. On the topic of the domestic parks, I wanted to ask you about the margins, which have been great. I mean, this fiscal year to date, they're up 150 basis points to over 22%. That's the highest we've seen in the trailing 10 years, if not longer. Can you discuss the drivers of the margin expansion and what your outlook is generally for the potential to keep growing them?
Drivers, really two simple things. Running them efficiently, great management at our parks. And second would be investment in great product. We made some really big and some really good bets. What we did in California at California Adventure is a great example of that, with Cars Land as a for instance. What we've done in Florida with Fantasyland, which was all redone and adding a Frozen attraction fairly recently, those made a big difference. And in terms of going forward, we think we still have margin expansion possibilities. Part of that is due to a continued focus on being ever more efficient, and part of it is due to the investments that we're making that have not opened yet. So we're going to open up a huge Pandora or Avatar Land in Animal Kingdom, and we've expanded Animal Kingdom significantly, which of all the parks, the four key parks in Orlando, was the only one that wasn't open at night. So it'll become a full-day experience. We also added a nighttime safari and some other entertainment. We're also building two very large, largest lands we've ever built, Star Wars attractions for Florida and for California. We haven't been specific about when those will come online, but we're in the building process already, so we've more than broken ground. We think those investments, particularly given the popularity of that franchise, will also serve us well in terms of margin expansion. So it's two things. It's running the business well and making the right investments.
Right.
And it's clearly paid off.
Driving top-line attendance and cost base is relatively fixed, so it gives you the opportunity.
Yes. There's obviously increased cost base with when your footprint grows. You need more people and more maintenance and just more service in general. But the popularity of what we put in is so strong that the efficiency of that in terms of the cost to deliver increased visitation is very, very high.
Yeah. Let's talk about the film
studio. That also, by the way, ties to the franchise. Well, you were going to talk about the film studio, but it ties to the franchise focus of the company too. The leverageability of those franchises at parks and resorts has driven real success in terms of margin expansion at parks and resorts. The most popular franchises are appearing more often at parks and resorts, not just domestically, but from Shanghai to Hong Kong to Paris to Tokyo. And that's, when you put popular things in, instead of things that people have never heard of before, obviously that helps your business.
Yeah. It's certainly a virtuous cycle. That's why those acquisitions that you made earlier, Pixar and Marvel, have been so important. But yeah, on the topic of the film studio, the global box office at your studio crossed $5 billion back in July, which is the fastest any studio has ever accomplished that feat. What do you think is the Disney difference at your film studio with respect to the creative and filmmaking process?
Well, we made a decision when I got the job that we were going to make fewer films, that we were going to focus on quality over quantity. We had seen some very sobering returns at our studio over the prior decade, and both live action and in animation, and looked at the industry and thought that that returns in general across the entire U.S. movie business were not impressive. And we thought one of the reasons for that is that too many movies were being made, too many bets being made, too much money being spent on, at least at that point, a business that we didn't think was expanding as much as just as with the volume of movies being released. So we said simply, let's make fewer and make bigger bets. We also thought that bigger bets, meaning tentpole films, had the ability to be leveraged more across the world, particularly as new markets emerged. And what's happened in the last 5 years in China is a great example of that. Tentpole films work really well there. So fewer films, more tentpole films, and then, of course, as we mentioned a few times, focus on Disney. We got out of the Miramax business, we got out of the Touchstone business, because our returns on Disney films and the Disney brand were strong. So, you know, make Disney. The investment in Pixar obviously supported that and actually gave us another brand to mine. Marvel, obviously the same thing. And then, of course, Star Wars. And it's just really worked. Our returns have been phenomenal. And, I mean, record returns for our movie business. And, you know, the $5 billion this year, I think, is a function of all we just discussed.
I mean, one of the things you do very differently than most of your peer studios is, you know, they're usually taking outside money. You know, they bring in co-finance partners. But to the best of my knowledge, I don't think that you guys do that. You know, you wholly finance it yourself. And I don't know if that means there's, you know, you have more creative control and so there's more of a vision on the direction of the movie. I don't know if you think that's an important factor or not.
Combination of things. First of all, we don't need money. We don't need outside money to fund these. We have a great capital structure. We believe in full ownership and full control forever because of the way we mine these properties across all of those businesses, and it just gets a little bit more complicated when you have partners, even though contracts can wall that off, just cleaner. And then we're in the business of taking big risks, and we believe in our creative and marketing and distribution capabilities. So the only reason to take outside money is to reduce risk, and you know we feel we've already done that with the strategy that we created to make fewer films and to focus on the films that we think matter the most to the global movie marketplace. Mm-hmm. So outside money is of absolutely no interest to us. It's been a while since we've taken it.
Yeah, and you've talked about, you know, the returns that you've been able to achieve, 20% plus, you know, it's probably more than double the peer average, if not more.
I think it's substantially more than 20%, too.
Okay. You know, so I guess I wonder how much of the outperformance on these returns would you attribute to your unique combination of the studio plus consumer products plus retail and theme parks?
Well, not much. We're fortunate to have a great consumer products business, and obviously some of the money that we mine from consumer products flows to the studio and is factored into returns that we look at. But, and I think at a prior conference I mentioned a statistic like this, but we bought Pixar and closed the deal in 2006. Since then, after we bought Marvel and Star Wars, we've released 29 films, make sure I get this right, under the Disney Animation, because we turned Disney Animation around, we bought Pixar. Disney Animation, Pixar, Marvel, and Lucas. 29 films since then. The average global box office of each of those films is a hair, and I mean a hair, under $800 million. So the returns that we talk about are not due to consumer products, they're due to the success, the direct success of those films. And the fact that we've figured out, it's not perfect science, obviously, and we have made some mistakes, but we figured out how to improve the odds of making good films. And we also have we've got great talent at our studio, led by Alan Horn, but then what we've done is we've created these individual sub-studios, Pixar and John Lasseter and Ed Catmull, and they run Disney Animation, Marvel under Kevin Feige, and Kathy Kennedy running Lucasfilm, and they basically have creative say over what they make, with obviously the watchful eye and hand of Alan and the studio team. And then what we've done is we've created great efficiency across those studios on the marketing and distribution and technology front. So we have a great system in place run by really strong people, managing great brands, telling great stories, and also thinking long-term. So most of the movies we make are not one-off movies. I had a meeting yesterday with Kathy Kennedy, and we mapped out, well, we reviewed the Star Wars plans that we have till 2020. We have movies in development for Star Wars till then, and we started talking about what we're going to do in 2021 and beyond. And so she's not just making a Star Wars movie, she's making a Star Wars universe of sorts. And we had a similar meeting with Marvel, I don't know, a week and a half ago, to plot that out, where we've got movies either in development or production, some nearing completion through the end of this decade. And we, too, are starting to talk about what do we do the next decade and so on. So I think it's a very, very different approach. And I will say, since we're on the subject, I did see Rogue One, which is really interesting in terms of the Star Wars storytelling. This is the film we have out this December. It's what we're calling a Star Wars story. So it does not fit neatly into what we call the Skywalker saga. The first six were George's. The seventh was the one that we released last December. The eighth is fully shot and being edited. That comes out in December of 17. And then the ninth, we just had a pitch from the director, because he's just going into pre-production, and that comes out in 2019. Then in between we have Rogue One, which is this December, which is about a band of rebels that are plotting to steal the plans to the Death Star, a story that would have taken place right before George's first movie. And then we have a movie coming out a couple of years that is an origin story about Han Solo and Chewie, and we've already cast a young Han Solo. And then we're already developing another Star Wars story for 2020, but even I'm starting to lose track. That we know we have not announced what it is, but we've got a writer on it already. But Rogue One, it's an experiment of sorts, because Star Wars has only been told as a saga, and this is a moment in time, and we've loved what we've seen.
I think you've been setting records on sort of number of views of the trailers online.
There's a lot of curiosity about it because it's Star Wars. So yes, the marketing material that we've had out has been extremely well received. We've not ever felt it would do the level that Force Awakens did, but we've been very, very encouraged that the level of interest in this is as high as it was for Force Awakens.
Let's talk about consumer products in a little more detail. The licensing and publishing revenue has kind of been a straight line up over the past 3 years to nearly $3 billion. It's about almost 1.5 times larger than it was 3 years ago. You know, the trailing 3 years have certainly had a tremendous content cycle, you know, Frozen, Star Wars, Marvel, and that obviously flows through on the consumer products. You know, as we look ahead, how should investors expect the growth to look? Can you sustain this, or do we have a little bit of a plateauing?
Well, we've doubled the size of consumer products from a bottom-line perspective over the last 4 years, and that's huge. We certainly don't believe we're going to do that. Some of that happened as a result of the acquisition of Lucas and bringing Marvel on board. We still see growth. We're not really predicting how much, how fast. There's some ins and outs. You know, Frozen, which stayed stronger, longer than we thought, has waned slightly, but we do have another Frozen movie in development, but that's for later on. We also have Cars being made and Toy Story being made, and I mentioned Star Wars and Marvel and Sony. It will distribute Spider-Man in 17, but we're making Spider-Man. We're rebooting Spider-Man. And we introduced new Spider-Man in Captain America Civil War this past year. So we feel good about that. That will help consumer products. So Spider-Man's the number one licensed Marvel character. So I think there's growth ahead for consumer products, but it will not be nearly as dramatic. It can't be as it has been the last 4 years.
Okay. Why don't I see if there are any questions from the audience. Thomas, just wait for the mic, please.
Thanks, Drew. Good morning, Bob.
Thomas?
On the last call, you were quite generous in talking about, or forward in terms of talking about your strategy with ESPN from a distribution perspective. Could you share a little bit how your, what's the go-forward strategy for ESPN's product and programming going forward, you know, how it will remain relevant with young generations, grow audience, grow engagement, et cetera? What will shift, how will that product look in 3 or 4 years from now?
Well, I think the primary programming approach that ESPN will take is not going to be all that different than it is today. I hope I'm right about this, but one of my team will correct me. I think they will present in this year 55,000 hours of live sports. Actually, the company is somewhere in the neighborhood of 75,000 hours of original programming, 55 of that from ESPN. That live sports product will form the basis of ESPN, no matter what platform ESPN sits on. So I don't think it'll change. They have talked about wanting to continue to reinvent their studio programming and strengthen their studio programming. They've made some changes already from a personnel perspective on that. They continue to consider ways that they can do that. They've also added to programming with, I think, some pretty unique product, the 30 for 30 product, as a for instance, which will become a nice brand, albeit a small business, but a nice brand enhancement for ESPN. What they did with the OJ, their OJ documentary or their OJ series, I thought was brilliant. So I don't think from a we'll call it a creative approach, it changes that much. We talked about how long they've licensed these sports as well, so I don't think the menu of sports changes. What I think will change is what we talked about, which is being more present in a more user-friendly way on mobile platforms so that their ubiquity is greater and the convenience is greater, and possibly creating product that's much more tailor-made or personalized, customized, personalized to their consumers who might be interested in more of a specific sport. That's pretty much it.
All right, thank you. And who do I check in with the Chewy role?
Who are you checking with for the Chewy
role?
How tall are you?
6'4".
You're not tall enough. The actor who originally played Chewy, I think, was just under around 7 feet. And was it Peter Mayhew? I think Peter Mayhew is his name. And Peter still, he voiced Chewy in Force Awakens. But the actor who's playing Chewy, not necessarily voice, but in the costume, in Star Wars 8 and in the movie that I talked about earlier, is about 7 feet as well. So you're too short.
Could you talk about Disney Interactive, please?
Yes, I can. Disney Interactive has tried a lot of things over the years. Some have worked, many have not. When we've gone the self-publishing route, we've, generally speaking, delivered results that were not as attractive as we would like or demand of ourselves, and so we find ourselves currently licensing more than publishing, and in virtually all of the product that we are that is out in the marketplace. There's still some vertically created games, largely coming out of our Asia Games unit, where they've had some real success, but they're modest in size, meaning total number, and our approach is likely to be, particularly since we've gotten out of Infinity, which had a good run the first run but then tailed off in the second and third iteration, but the approach is likely to remain the same, which is license, not make. One of the biggest successes we've had doing that in the last 12 months has been the EA relationship that we created with Star Wars, for instance, which was hugely successful both for them and for us. Larry Haverty.
Yes. Bob, the market in its wisdom floated Formula One and gave it a valuation of around 17 times cash flow. So you've got this sports business sitting in your company, and from time to time people would say this is the most valuable cable network there is, and it's hidden in the cable network so that people can't look at it on a segment basis and put a multiple on it. Have you or the board considered breaking out the profits of ESPN within the company's reporting system so that perhaps those people who might value it higher than the corporate whole for various and sundry reasons might be given an opportunity with real data rather than just trying to guess?
There isn't enough speculation already about ESPN, or enough talk about it. You want to morph from speculation to specificity, right? I think there's enough pressure on ESPN in terms of its bottom line, which is still healthy and is still growing and will continue to grow. We have the new NBA deal in 17, I'll remind people, which we've talked about, which is a slight hiccup for 17, but we believe ESPN is going to continue to grow, albeit not at the rate that it has grown over the last decade. So it's still a healthy business. The way we manage these businesses is we distribute them, meaning our media networks, with one entity. We've actually talked about creating even more synergies in other areas to reduce some expenses and be more effective. And we've just felt that putting a brighter spotlight on the business and maybe creating even more pressure than we've already seen is not necessarily something that we want to do. And we don't feel it's a necessity for us. We don't have a need. We think that ESPN is the most valuable network that's out there. We're not going to put a number on what that is, but I guess that's for all of you to figure out.
Okay, well, we are out of time. Thank you so much, Bob, for being here.
Thanks very much, Drew. Thank you.